for it. It fixed its black beady eyes on Victor and gurgled with sudden interest.
"I don't know why calling people nasty names is so important to you," said Adam, who was taking cover around the corner.
The creature leapt. Its legs pushed it into the air with the power of a flea, and all of its teeth and claws curled outwards, ready to pull flesh and bone apart. Victor extended a hand, and the entire tunnel burst into flames. The creature screeched and attempted to arrest its leap by grabbing the nearest wooden beam, but Victor projected the fire, sending a wave of living flame along the passage, flash roasting the beast alive. "It's not," he said, looking at Adam. "See, you're twisting my words. This always happens. That's what makes it impossible to have a conversation about this."
"Victor," admonished Adam.
"What?"
"You didn't say the words."
"Alpha." He folded his arms, directed his gaze at the ceiling, and adopted a passive-aggressive sing-song voice. "We are official representatives of the Department of Extra-Dimensional Affairs. If you are sentient, please state your intentions immediately, and we will provide whatever medical services or transportation you require." The sizzling creature responded by tilting its discolored head like a quizzical dog. Then it reared up and unfilled its teeth again with a hiss. Victor promptly atomized it, turning the section of sandy ground around it into a circle of glass.
"There's two more of them further down,"
said Adam, squinting and apparently looking at the floor.
"I really think there's a big flaw with this policy."
Victor snorted so hard he made himself cough. "Yeah, I completely agree. Having to stand here like an unused prick, gabbing off while the monsters are flying at my face. I'm seeing a few big flaws with that one."
"No, I mean, we didn't know the fluidics were intelligent at first because we couldn't communicate, right? But we still expect these things to understand a statement in spoken English?"
"It jumped at my face, screaming, with its claws out. I call that pretty sodding universal language. Where's the next one?" Adam nodded towards a rusted metal gate that was hanging off its hinges, which had been the source of the clanging noise earlier.
"Down there. You blasted that thing without even a word. Maybe it didn't know you were intelligent?"
In Adam's mind's eye, the trails indicating the movements of the remaining creatures hung in the air like glowing red streamers, and lent a much-needed festivity to the tunnels, which were only getting grimmer. They were entering the oldest tunnels now, the ones that had probably been abandoned even while the rest of the mine was active, and signs of human construction were becoming less and less frequent. "Oh, sure. How could it have possibly figured it out?" said Victor. "I mean, here I am walking upright and dressed in manufactured clothing, but I suppose I could have been a ravenous monster that nicked the coat, torn it off someone with my teeth and accidentally put it on while trying to wipe my bum with it. That was the stupidest thing you've ever said."
"All right, all right."
"And hey, crawling around naked in an abandoned mine doesn't mean these things aren't intelligent, sure. After all, it's a well-known hallmark of intelligence. Noam Chomsky's down here every other bloody weekend."
"One's coming at us," pointed out Adam helpfully.
Victor peered ahead, and his flashlight reflected off a generous cluster of expanding fangs. "Official representatives, Department of etc., state intentions." One fraction of a second later, he filled the passage with boiling flames from floor to ceiling.
"Victor..."
"What? We've got to be efficient, haven't we? Don't my instincts count for anything? Where's the last one?"
"Sneaking up on us."
Victor coolly pointed his hand over his shoulder, and the pair of them were bathed in violently flickering yellow light for a moment, before something that had been crawling on the ceiling hit the floor with a wet crackle. "Can we go now?" Adam scowled.
"Look, we can't just slack off on the sentience checks. Maybe it was obvious this time, but it only takes one mistake. One mistake, and the department gets raked over the coals again."
"Can we go now?"
"No, there's..."
Adam frowned as he consulted his inner eye.
"There's something else. It's..."
Victor watched Adam impatiently as his brow furrowed further, and he turned on his heel, psychically sniffing the air. "It's what?"
"It's back there. It's something, but it's really faint, just a trace."
"Fine, lead the way." Adam did so, taking point as the duo turned back towards the newer tunnels.
"This is something different, so make sure you do the sentience check properly."
"You were the one who said the sentience check was pointless 10 minutes ago. Do you even listen to yourself?"
"I did not say that it was pointless," said Adam, with a tolerant sigh. "I said that there were flaws with it."
"Well, you should have said it was pointless, because it is." The trail was weak, but peaked in the long entrance tunnel from which most of the smaller routes branched. Even then, it wasn't much more than a series of muddy brown particles that were already winking out of existence, but there were enough to indicate towards the tunnel's far end.
So, just because the solution isn't 100% perfect, you're willing to throw it away and go back to 0%?
Said Adam. Bollocks, is it a solution? It's just PR. The makers do it so they can pretend they fixed the problem. No one really cares.
No, you don't care. Other people care. I imagine the interdimensional sentience you're blasting would care.
Okay, look. The Fluidics had the right idea, didn't they? Said Victor. They figured out how to get their intentions across. If a monster can't be bothered to do enough research to figure out that we wear clothes in this universe and don't bite each other's faces off as a greeting, why is it our fault when things get confused?
Adam stared at him, open-mouthed. So we should kill every refugee who comes to the country and doesn't speak English, should we?
You're twisting my words again. I'm just saying...
Victor's words died as his flashlight beam fell upon the sight in front of them.
What's that?
The way ahead had been cut off by a collapse centuries ago, and some boards had been put up in front of it as a sort of official surrender to nature. Spread across the floor just in front of the wall was a spectacular display of colourful liquid, like the aftermath of a child getting bored with their chemistry set and seeing what would happen if they mixed everything together. In the centre of it was a pile of what looked like white sand, surrounded by a ring of greenish-brown sludge that spiked outwards violently as if trying to escape. The fringes had crisped to an unhealthy black, like a poorly cooked fried egg. Adam took a step forward, and something crunched under his sneaker. There was more of the white sand, forming a line that went all the way across the passage. Except now that he could get a closer look, it wasn't sand.
Salt, he identified aloud.
Why have your senses led us to a bunch of salt? Asked Victor dryly. Do they want fish and chips for lunch?
Victor... I think this is a fluidic, said Adam, not wanting to get any closer. I think someone trapped a fluidic here and killed it. With salt?
Victor stared at the stain that had once been a sentient creature. Then he shone his flashlight upwards, revealing a large piece of cardboard that had been very recently hung from the boards on the far wall. On it, in the patient, meticulous style of cold, sober premeditation, someone had painted an icon of a hand. It was a familiar symbol to both the agents. Up until 3 months ago, they had seen it almost every day, on the archway that led to the Hand of Merlin's meeting chamber, in the secret bunker under Westminster Abbey.
Let's make it a long lunch, said Victor, not looking away from it.
20. The Department of Extradimensional Affairs, formerly the Ministry of Occultism, was no longer based in the secret bunker. They had been granted a couple of floors in one of the more modern buildings on Victoria Street, begrudgingly hacked out from the Department of Business. Elizabeth Lawrence had fought to the very limits of passive aggression to avoid being given an obvious, important-looking office to no avail. She had been assigned the largest one, right next to the Secretary of State's. She had attempted to politely ignore it and work in one of the smaller adjoining offices, but Anderson had strategically disconnected the computers one by one, until Elizabeth was finally forced to work in her intended office, now an island in the middle of a lake of dead monitors. She sat supporting her chin on one hand, behind a thoroughly modern white desk that would have made someone twice her size look diminutive. As Richard Danvers entered and took a seat, she addressed the smartphone in front of her.
"Say again what you just told me." "We found a dead fluidic in the mine where the targets were hanging out," said Adam on speaker. "Someone piled a load of salt onto it." "Could the creatures you were hunting have done it?"
There was a low muttering in the background.
"No, they weren't sentient. Totally 100% certain about that. We did the checks. Whoever killed the fluidic trapped it with a line of salt. That's too smart for the things we just killed."
"Surely this becomes a police matter now?"
said Danvers, folding his arms.
"Tell him what else you found," prompted Elizabeth. "They put a sign up above the corpse," said Adam. "It had the Hand of Merlin symbol on it, like a sort of signature."
Danvers considered this for a moment, then urgently leaned forward. "I'll send a crew. In the meantime, keep guard over the crime scene and make sure no one finds or disturbs it."
Keep guard?"
Elizabeth coughed lightly.
"Since you called to inform us of this immediately, Hesketh, you must still be at the crime scene."
There was the sound of Victor Kaysen coughing on something, and of a mug of tea hitting the kind of cheap dining table one might find at a service station cafe.
Yes, right, we'll guard this crime scene we're at.
Elizabeth ended the call, then leaned back and looked to Richard expectantly. It hadn't escaped her attention that the former swordkeeper, now Chief Inspector Danvers, had been noticeably less stressed since they had become the new department and moved to an office more like his natural environment. The moment Adam had mentioned the Hand of Merlin, Richard's hands had started to quake.
"What do you think?" asked Elizabeth.
"I don't think they really were still at the crime scene," said Richard guardedly. Elizabeth stared at him until he continued.
"What I also don't think is that the former members of the Hand have formed some kind of underground anti-magic terrorist group."
"Have you had any contact with your father recently?" said Elizabeth. Richard looked her in the eye.
"The last I heard, he was building a train set," he said through his teeth. "Come on, Elizabeth. The Hand were and still are a bunch of confused old men who were only in the Ministry for the Secret Club and the fine dining."
Elizabeth glanced at the door, in case a fully equipped surveillance team had arrived and set up their mics in the few moments since she had last checked, then leaned in.
"We know that, yes. But say we didn't, and only knew of the Hand of Merlin what the media has said about them, what would we assume from this incident?"
"We would assume that the Hand may have gone underground to continue their campaign against fluidics."
"Precisely. Which is why we need to handle this quietly. If any more scrutiny comes down on the old ministry, it's only a matter of time before our prior connection to it is revealed."
Richard's expression hardened. "I understand that, but a person is dead, Elizabeth, a thinking, feeling person. We're occult detectives, we're not detective detectives.
If the killer had a working understanding of magic, this remains in our purview," said Elizabeth coolly.
"And if they didn't? Plenty of people know the Hand of Merlin's symbol. Seemed like the media had nothing else to talk about 3 months ago."
"Is it widely known that salt can kill Shoggoths?"
Richard winced at the sound of the word. "Anyone could figure it out. All it takes is one accident. And we publish a list of food items to remove from donated garbage, so it wouldn't take an expert to figure out the common denominator."
"Then what about the creatures in the mine, the ones Hesketh and Kaysen were sent to deal with? It's too much of a coincidence that the killer chose that mine in particular. I think we were being led there. The sign indicates as much. They wanted us to see their work."
"Still doesn't mean they had to know their magic.
Either they knew the monsters were living there and knew how to avoid or defend against them," said Elizabeth, with the air of one casually moving a piece into checkmate, "or they knew how to trap and bind the creatures. Either suggests a practitioner of some level.
Flimsy,
but sufficient to keep this our case until we can get to the bottom of it, unless you'd like the press to descend upon your father again."
The rapid pit-pat of soft shoes on modern carpeting added an ellipsis to Richard's irritated sigh, and Alison Arkin appeared at the office door, hand already poised to knock before she was in range. She said, "Anderson's here."
Elizabeth and Richard exchanged a concerned look. "How loud is he being?" asked Elizabeth. "On a scale of 1 to 10.
We're probably up to a 9, said Alison. "He's got a serious stomp going on."
"He doesn't know, does he?" whispered Danvers. "I don't see how he could, unless he has this office bugged," replied Elizabeth.
A moment's thought later, she secretly ran her hand along the underside of her desk.
"You don't have to leave," she added, as Danvers rose from his seat. "He's going to order me out anyway. He always does. I think it's a power thing." "Not necessarily."
They felt the stomping before they heard it. It was shaking the entire floor. Each of Anderson's footfalls was answered by a rattle of keyboards and loose items of stationery, as Elizabeth's walking stick, leaning on the side of the desk, began to stutteringly slide to the ground. Anderson appeared. His face was the color of a stop sign, and his neck was on maximum bulge. "Danvers out!" were the first words out of his mouth as he made a beeline for the guest chair. "Coffee, girl, get coffee." As Danvers and Alison left, with rolling eyes and nonplussed expression respectively, a woman Elizabeth didn't recognize entered and closed the door behind them. She was Anderson's age, dressed in a jet-black pantsuit and a loose ponytail the exact same color. She opted not to take a seat, but leaned demurely against the wall with hands behind back. Anderson stared at the door until Danvers and Allison's footsteps were no longer audible, then slowly turned to Elizabeth, his neck rotating like the steel door of an interrogation cell.
Did I not tell you, when we began this little adventure together, that we did not want any nasty surprises down the line?
Not in those exact words, said Elizabeth, keeping up her bored, unintimidated face.
We found the school, you psycho, said Anderson,
humorlessly.
That little Soviet gulag you've got running in Devonshire.
I told you, we offer magically infused young people protection and education.
You didn't tell me you kept them in a torture dungeon. Man alive, what is wrong with you people?
Rhetorical question. Don't answer that, we'll be here all day. You have to understand that it presents a very problematic image, said the dark-haired woman. It represents an institutional oppression of what many consider to be an underprivileged minority. Elizabeth blinked as if this was the first time she had noticed the other woman. And you are?
Dr. Nita Pavani, said Anderson,
just as Pavani herself opened her mouth to answer.
Special diversity advisor. And you and her are going to be seeing a lot of each other while she gets this department up to standard.
You have to understand, said Elizabeth, addressing Pavani directly, that educating the magically infused requires a specific methodology. The practices of the secondary school have been honed to perfection over the course of the last century.
Yeah, 'cause that always works, interjected Anderson. We saw how finely owned your cockin' and of Merlin were.
This is a more modern age, said Pavani. Her voice was smooth and understanding, and always had a hint of apology about it. Helping the underprivileged... Underprivileged is not the word I would use, said Elizabeth, to describe individuals with the capacity to exert their will upon the fabric of reality. Discipline is required if their abilities are to be managed and suppressed. Suppressed? Repeated Pavani, eyebrows rising. You force them to conceal their cultural identities. Elizabeth wasn't sure how she had been lured into this battle to the death, but she was damned if she was going to get pushed onto the defensive now. She locked gazes with the younger woman, just as one would suppress any cultural identity that could potentially result in the deaths of countless innocents, yes. Pavani's eyebrows, having only just settled back down into neutral, jumped for the top of her scalp once again. Many would consider that an offensive statement, Miss Lawrence. Do you even allow them a say in how their lives are dictated? We have successful graduates of the program working in this very department. Anderson scoffed. He was leaning back on his chair, enjoying the show.
Yeah, Kaysen and Esketh. Real bleeding success stories, those two. The firebug and the neckbeard.
I think a complete inspection and overhaul of this program will have to take place as soon as possible, said Pavani to Anderson.
I think we're in complete agreement, Doctor,
said Anderson, arms folded. Elizabeth clasped her hands on the desk in front of her, closed her eyes, and counted silently to 10. Displaying such serenity that even Anderson was hesitant to interrupt. Finally, she spoke. Do either of you know what happens to these individuals if they are not taught how to suppress their magical infusion?
Can't say we do,
said Anderson, smile frozen. Then I'd like you to meet someone. 21. Allison, with a tray of coffee cups in hand, performed a minor act of pelvic gymnastics to show the security guard the ID badge on her belt, then made her way across the lobby to the elevators. For her part, she liked working out of the new office. It wasn't as scarily fascinating as the secret bunker, but at least she didn't have to live on site, and had been assigned a small but homely apartment just a few tube stations away. There was no longer a chance of getting lost at night while looking for a bathroom and stumbling into a storage room full of quivering pseudo-life forms in specimen jars. But what Allison liked most was feeling that she belonged to something. She loved that she needed an ID card to be allowed into the building. In quiet moments, she would take it out and admire it, running her finger along the laminated words, Junior Agent, Department of Extradimensional Affairs. She wished the photo had been taken before her eager smile had glazed over, but she loved it anyway. Despite her having only been there for days, the rest of the old ministry hands had wordlessly accepted her as part of the old guard during the move from the bunker to Victoria Street, and that had left her in high spirits. There had been a real sense of pulling together against the common foe with every grumbling trip to and from the removals vans. She stood waiting for the elevator to arrive, shifting her weight from leg to leg. What she liked most of all about working at the new office, she realized to herself, was not being in the field with Dr. Diablerie.
"Hello, Allison,"
said a voice at floor level.
"How's all day going?"
Allison looked to see Shukshuthux, the fluidic who worked in the records department.
They were technically housemates, as Shugshutuks had been housed in the section of sewer directly beneath Allison's new apartment building, and it was her job to bring the bags of garbage down for him every day. "Hi, Shugshutuks, great as always," she said, bouncing on her heels, the only cheerful body language she could manage with the tray of coffee cups occupying both hands. "Got to get these to Mr. Anderson. He just burst in looking mad about something."
"Oh."
Shugshutuks expelled a little poot of gas to fill a brief, thoughtful pause.
"What does Mr. Anderson look like when he isn't mad about something?"
"I'll let you know as soon as I find out. How's your day going?"
"Could be better."
Part of Shugshutuks emitted another puff of gas in a manner intended to resemble a sigh.
"Shugshutuks got murdered."
"He got what?"
"Murdered. Someone locked them in a mine and killed them. All Fluidics felt air pain."
Allison boggled. "Murdered? That's horrible." She glanced up. "Do you think that's what Mr. Anderson was angry about?"
"Oh, I hope not,"
burbled Shugshutuks.
"We don't want everyone to make a fuss."
He rotated a little and extruded a couple of fresh sensing organs.
"Do you know that person?"
Allison turned to look at where Shugshutuks's newest tentacle was pointing. There was someone standing on the far side of the security desk, waving with both hands to get Allison's attention. The laptop bag dangling from her shoulder made an independent waving motion to enhance the effect.
"Jessica Weatherby?" breathed Allison, hands tightening around the drinks tray with a crunch of distressed cardboard.
"Sorry, could you hold this for a moment?" She dreamily passed the tray over to Shugshutuks, who was only just able to catch it with a panicky cluster of new limbs.
"Hi,"
said Jessica, as Allison wordlessly took her by the elbow and pulled her into a quiet corner of the lobby, an attempt at a welcoming smile frozen on her face.
"I was so glad that I saw you here. I didn't know who to talk to."
"What are you doing here?" asked Allison, as loudly as she dared.
"Well, I didn't have anywhere to go,"
said Jessica, doing a sterling impression of a lost puppy.
"And then I heard on the news that the old thing got shut down."
"Thing?"
"Yeah, you know, the old government magic office and the school thing, so I thought maybe I could come here and they could tell me where to go."
"Jessica, the thing is, the school might not completely be shut down yet," said Allison, her voice becoming strained as she picked her words carefully. "It's not quite safe for you to be out in the open."
"But the old thing was shut down."
She made the puppy face again.
"This is a completely new thing, isn't it?"
Allison took a quick glance around for eavesdroppers, but only saw Shugshutuks, who was now keeping the cardboard tray aloft by adopting the approximate shape of a half-melted coffee table.
"Yes, of course, but some of the old systems take time to take apart, you understand? But you're here?"
She pointed to Allison's ID card.
"You work here, and you escaped from the school too, didn't you?"
"Yes, of course I did, but look, Jessica, can't you go back to your parents or something?"
"I tried that. They just told me to go back to the school."
She blinked.
"Oh, yeah, I needed to ask about that as well. Do you know where Aaron is?"
A guilty tingle ran down Allison's spine. "Your brother?" she stalled, rubbing the back of her neck.
"Yeah, Mum and Dad said he wasn't taken back to the school. They don't know where he is now. Have you heard from him?"
Allison looked over her shoulder, then took Jessica's arm again. "Actually, it's so good to see you. Why don't we do a proper catch-up over lunch? I'll buy. There's a really nice place just 6 or 7 blocks away." Shugshutuks watched them go. He carefully placed the cups on a nearby bench, one by one, then digested the cardboard tray with a contented slurp. 22.
"Obviously the new building doesn't have precisely the same facilities as the bunker," said Elizabeth, as the rickety maintenance elevator made its way down to the sub-sub-basement. "Happily, we were able to improvise what we needed for certain specific purposes."
Dr. Pavani was getting more and more twitchy and uncomfortable the deeper into the building they went. Her hands, previously clasped in a permanent gesture of slightly condescending appeasement, were now hugging her torso. "Does this really need to be in the basement? Many would say this isn't a suitable work environment."
"I'm afraid it does," said Elizabeth. "If this is making you nervous, Doctor, I'm sure Mr. Anderson could manage this by himself."
"She's not nervous. Don't give her the satisfaction, Nita,"
said Anderson, standing unfazed with arms folded.
"There's nothing to be afraid of.
This department's crazy, but it's not murder in the basement crazy.
Excuse me, Sean, I would appreciate it if you didn't speak on my behalf, said Pavani. Anderson rolled his eyes and took an interest in the maximum occupancy sign. Miss Lawrence, what exactly do you intend to show us?
First, a little background. Do you know where magic comes from?
I was not aware that magic came from something specific, admitted Pavani. I heard it was just part of the atmosphere, like nitrogen.
It comes from an alternative dimension parallel to our own, known as the ethereal realm, said Elizabeth, in the tone of a bored lecturer, facing the door with hands behind back. It originates from vast intelligences known as ancients or elder gods. The fluidics, for example, are individual cells of an ancient named Shugshithuks that have broken away and formed distinct consciousnesses.
And I'm lost, said Anderson,
to fill Elizabeth's pause for effect.
A magically infused being comes about when one of the tiny magical particles that bleed through from the other realm bonds with the developing consciousness of a newborn being from this universe. This results in a human or animal whose natural abilities are enhanced by the magic particle's capacity to impose upon the surrounding physical universe in accordance with its will. Do you follow?
Of course. What you mean is their abilities are an integral part of their identities from birth, said Pavani. How does this justify suppressing them, Miss Lawrence?
The elevator shuddered to a halt, and the heavy doors slid aside to reveal a concrete tunnel, lit by electric lamps similar to those that the bunker had used.
This way, said Elizabeth.
Her walking stick made a particularly resonant sound in the dingy concrete atmosphere. Pavani followed, shivering with the slight draught, and Anderson brought up the rear, raising his feet sarcastically high with each step. They rounded a corner into a large room that had once been part of the underground car park, but which had been sealed off with concrete and welded steel walls, so that the maintenance elevator was the only way in or out. Additional slabs of steel had been placed along the lines of the former parking spaces to turn them into inescapable cells, each with a heavy plexiglass door that allowed a view inside.
What you have to understand is that magic is the essence of consciousness, continued Elizabeth as she led her two visitors along rows of empty cells. A magical infusion means having a second, more primitive consciousness inside your mind, one with a direct connection to an ancient, which will gradually work to overpower the original consciousness and seize control of the body. This is the condition commonly referred to as demonic possession.
She stopped at a cell guarded by a single low-ranking agent with an assault rifle, who gave her a respectful nod and her two companions a suspicious glare. Elizabeth turned to them and held out a hand towards the plexiglass door of the cell, like a theatre usher politely indicating a seat. Pavani and Anderson peered in like zoo patrons. At the far end of the cell, facing the wall, stood a young man. He was dressed in an orange boiler suit with the upper half knotted untidily around his waist, exposing his chest. His pale skin was marred with green blotches and lumps that started at the small of his back, climbed to his left shoulder, and ended at the side of his head, leaving a large green crater in his thick black hair.
"His name is, or was, Aaron Weatherby," said Elizabeth. "He escaped from the school during a pivotal moment in his education. He was demonically possessed as a result of not having the appropriate guidance and discipline."
Sensing that he was under scrutiny, Aaron turned, tottered, then walked straight at his visitors at full speed, slapping face first into the solid plexiglass. The cluster of fat tentacles bursting from the left side of his face cushioned the impact and writhed against the transparent wall in every direction. Anderson reflexively hopped back, holding the back of his hand to his mouth.
"Oh my God!"
Pavani started, but remained where she was, not blinking.
"As you can see, a certain amount of physical mutation has taken place," said Elizabeth, fearlessly running her hand along the plexiglass like a weather reporter. "As I said, the magic particle has a limited ability to exert its will upon physical reality, and since it still believes itself to be a component of the ancient, the physical change is a result of the identity crisis."
The Aaron creature opened its mouth, and from its throat came what sounded like two voices speaking in unison.
"Release us!"
"All right, you made your point,"
said Anderson, backing away further. He had turned very white.
Keep doing whatever the hell the school does. Let's go.
Wait, spat Pavani, flashing him a brief glance of utter fury before taking a deep, shaky breath and turning back to Elizabeth. You still haven't explained why you have locked them up in this cell. Elizabeth's confident air gave way to bafflement. He's possessed by an ancient. And when will they be released? When Aaron has learned to suppress the other side of himself. Elizabeth looked him up and down distastefully. We can help him along with rituals and medicine, but he has to meet us halfway. He has to want to be cured.
We do not want,
intoned Aaron. Pavani drew herself up haughtily. Many would consider this a fundamental violation of rights and denial of personal agency, she said, breathing heavily. You said ancients are intelligent. I said they are vast intelligences, and that people with magical infusions can prevent being transformed like this if they choose to. Elizabeth and the Aaron creature exchanged a confused glance. Yes, if they are taught how. Therefore, they can also permit it to happen should they choose to. Pavani folded her arms. What you're showing me is a private agreement between two sentients, both perfectly capable of making their own decisions. It should be treated like a business interest, or a civil partnership, not locked away until they are forced to change themselves to be in line with someone else's unchallenged moral dictation. Elizabeth did the weather reporter wave again, rapidly up and down as she sought the words. Doctor, the boy has tentacles growing out of his face. I find it rather disturbing that you believe in judging people by their appearance. Elizabeth had had enough. She raised her head and shoulders and gripped her walking stick tightly, grinding the end into the floor. When she spoke, her 5-foot frame seemed to fill the room. The ancients are a race of unthinkable monstrosities, she announced, her words echoing through the concrete and sending vibrations through the steel. They must not be allowed to pervert the minds of human beings and exert their agenda upon our world. By the end of her statement, Pavani and Anderson were both leaning back like trees in a gale. After a pregnant pause, it was Anderson who spoke first, leaning back in and blinking rapidly.
So, what is their agenda?
Elizabeth's eyes flicked to him, her expression fixed. What?
Simple enough question. You seem to be in the know about these things. What do they want?
Her eyes glazed for a second, lingering on memories, before refocusing on him. They have designs on our universe, she said.
Yeah, all right, that's pretty evident, said Anderson, nodding to Aaron. But what exactly do they want?
Yes, what do you mean by designs? Pressed Pavani, recovering rapidly. Any refugee or legal immigrant could be said to have designs. Do they mean actual harm? Do they mean to oppress anyone?
In my experience, said Elizabeth, her voice breaking into a slight, barely detectable quaver with the word, it is not an agenda that means us well.
And how much experience is that? Asked Pavani. The ancients are all individuals, aren't they? How many individual hostile ancients with harmful agendas do you know of? Know for absolute certainty, I mean? Elizabeth sighed with irritation, partly at the ignorance before her, partly because she knew precisely how they would react to the answer she was about to give.
At least one.
Just one, said Anderson.
At least one.
Pavani pointed into the cell. This one?
No.
Pavani addressed the Aaron thing directly, swallowing back a delicate little gag. Excuse me, to whom am I speaking?
We are Aaron Weatherby,
said Aaron Weatherby.
And we are Bjarkthen. We two are as one.
Well, could I possibly ask you to go back to being two for a moment so I can talk to Bjarkthen by himself? Or herself? Please tell me your preferred pronouns. Aaron's one visible eye vibrated madly in confusion.
We two are as one.
You'll get no sense out of them, said Elizabeth. It's the nature of the corruption. Excuse me, barked Pavani, flashing Elizabeth the evil eye, before returning to Aaron Bjarkthen. I do apologize. I am going to request that you educate me on how you prefer to identify. Can I ask what it is that you want? The tentacles pressed even further against the glass with a little squeak of escaping air.
We want to be free.
I'm sorry, I should have been clearer.
What do you intend to do with your lives when you are free? Aaron Bjarkthen's roving eye was the only movement in the room. Pavani held her clasped hands in front of her. Anderson leaned forward interestedly. Elizabeth stood frozen with her arms folded.
We,
croaked the creature in the cell.
We will see the new interstellar bum pirates.
23. Allison re-entered the lobby of the Department of Extra-Dimensional Affairs building, absent-mindedly flashed her ID card as she went past the security desk, then punched the elevator call button, resting her forehead on the wall above the panel. Lunch had taken rather longer than she had anticipated.
"Sorry I ate the coffee twy," said Shugstux.
Allison turned to look at him, grinding her head against the wall to do so, then at the nearby bench on which the four cups had been arranged equidistantly with reverent care. "Oh, God, I forgot. I was supposed to be bringing those to Miss Lawrence."
"Will Miss Lawrence still want them?"
On cue, Elizabeth Lawrence herself emerged from a nearby door labelled Authorized Personnel Only, allowing it to fly open and hit the wall with a thunderous crash. The violent stabbing of her walking stick into the ground added a prosthetic echo to the initial noise. "Something tells me we're past coffee," muttered Allison, watching her. Elizabeth glanced up, met Allison's gaze, and made a beeline for her. The clacking of the walking stick was like the rhythmic sound of a steam engine bearing inexorably down. "Allison," she said, in stern, hushed tones, "have you and Diablerie made any headway into finding Weatherby's sister?" "No," said Allison, telling herself that it wasn't technically a lie. She and Diablerie, as a single entity, had not made any headway into bringing in Jessica. "Prioritize it higher. The girl may be in imminent danger." "From what?" On cue, again, the door opened a second time, more gently. Sean Anderson held it open as Nita Pavani passed through, talking animatedly. "Obviously there'll need to be some kind of hearing," said Pavani, eyes sparkling. "We need to ensure that the Aaron personality still has a presence within the hybrid consciousness and consents to the arrangement, but I think the Interstellar Bum Pirates reference already confirms that." "Aha," said Anderson, queasily. His face had not yet returned to its usual complexion. "Education, that's what's most important." Bavani's hands were unconsciously rattling on an invisible keyboard. "I'll have to work out a whole new curriculum for the school. Obviously we can't let interdimensional sentience hybridize anyone under the age of consent. We just need to teach these kids enough that they can make an informed choice."
"As to whether they want to be possessed by demons," clarified Anderson.
Pavani blinked at him as she mentally switched from automatic back to manual. "Excuse me, Sean, but I would prefer it if you used an appropriate term. Dual consciousness or hybrid consciousness? Many would consider demonic possession offensive."
"Many don't even know it's a slur yet," said Anderson irritably. "It's only been one for 5 minutes."
"Every slur was once 5 minutes old. It didn't make them any less damaging." Her eyes glazed over again. "We need to get Aaron and Bjarkthen on camera. Newsnight interview. No, Saturday morning show. Something youth-oriented. Can you imagine how many persons of dual consciousness will have the confidence to come forward?" Anderson pinched his eyes. By now, the two of them had drifted over to the elevator where Allison and Elizabeth were waiting, and he directed his voice at Allison for want of an impartial audience.
"Do you want to hear something funny? I brought her here because I thought she could bring some sanity to this department. One meeting later, it seems we're jumping off two lunatic fringes at once."
"Sean," said Pavani, with a matronly scold, "I've told you before about that word."
"Go in now,"
declared Anderson, clamping his hands over his ears and striding towards the exit. He paused halfway and turned, very nearly concussing a passing civil servant with his extruding elbows.
"Nita, you work here now. Sort this out between you. As long as the government comes out of this looking good, then I couldn't give a hybrid consciousness shit."
As the minor tremors from his footfalls faded away, Pavani gave Elizabeth and Allison an apologetic smile. He places so much importance on having the last word. "It's rather childish, really, isn't it?" Elizabeth stared at her, keeping her expression neutral, like a Soviet nation closing its borders as it begins a top-secret weapons program. "Allison," she said, "it seems Dr. Pavani will be taking an advisory role within the department. Please ensure she has a suitable workspace."
With that, she turned smartly on her heel and jabbed the elevator call button.
"Hello, nice to meet you, Allison. I'm Nita Pavani. Please call me Nita," said Pavani in a single, well-rehearsed blast.
"Hello, nice to meet you. I'm Allison," returned Allison, tottering slightly.
"Sorry you had to be around for Sean's little tantrum," said Pavani, leaning close like an affectionate older sister. She gave a little adrenaline-fueled puff.
"Whew, I think we're all rather heated from what we discovered today."
"Oh, right," said Allison. She rocked on her heels as the elevator slowly descended, searching for something else to add.
"It threw me, too. Why would anyone do that to a fluidic?"
There was a soft bump as Elizabeth's forehead gently collided with the wall above the elevator panel, adding to the little stain that Allison herself had left. Pavani fluttered her eyelashes and smiled hollowly.
"I'm sorry."
"What?"
24.
Is it really so controversial to say that it's confusing how every single fluidic is named Shugtathuks?
This comment has 276 dislikes.
Wow.
Racist much?
God damn, I don't even know you anymore, man.
Fuck you!
This comment has 83 likes.
Names redacted.
25.
Tremble in your comfort zones, people of the mundane world, said the human-sized cloud of red smoke that was unfolding in the underground car park. Diablery has returned to... What is that thing doing here?
What thing? Asked Allison. Diablery flapped his cloak left and right until enough of the smoke dispersed that she could see where he was pointing.
That infernal dollop of hellspawn!
This is Shugtathuks, said Allison in a hurt voice.
He's a fluidic. I don't think you're supposed to say hellspawn anymore, Doctor.
Diablery bows to no authority.
He wrinkled his nose up and threw his cloak up over his face for the first time that day. Are we called upon to exterminate a single Shoggoth? Must Diablery forever waste away on such crass trivialities?
No, we're investigating the murdered fluidic, said Allison, getting between him and Shugtathuks protectively. I thought Shugtathuks could help, because fluidics seem to have a sort of psychic link.
Investigate? Murder?
Diablery snorted.
Afterwards, perhaps we might investigate the matter of who murdered the mildew stain on the bathroom tiles. Hold! 'Twas the chambermaid! Another murder solved by Diablery.
Allison left a sizable silence after he had finished, gaping with horrified disbelief.
Haven't you heard that fluidics are actual citizens now?
Pah! Diablery has higher concerns. Surely you do not propose to admit this foulness to my vehicle's upholstery?
I really don't want all the fuss,
squelched Shugtathuks, fluttering some stubby tentacles, the fluidic equivalent of anxious thumb twiddling.
No, it's all right, said Allison, opening one of the rear doors. I bought one of those new fluidic car seats, see?
It wasn't much more than a large tub with slots on the side to admit a standard seatbelt, moulded from plastic a shade of organic dark green that accompanied fluidic colours well. Shugtathuks slithered across the concrete and poured himself into it, taking as much care as he could to avoid touching any other part of the car. It looked like reversed footage of a bird defecating. Diablery eyeballed the fluidic as it arranged itself into the approximate shape of a sitting dog.
"Elizabeth Lawrence herself gave Diablery this task?"
"Yes, to both of us," said Allison, one hand on the driver's side door handle.
Diablery met her gaze.
"Why?"
Allison reddened.
"Because it's suddenly become quite important."
"Ugh!"
Diablery moved to the passenger door.
"If Diablery's dark power must be squandered to serve the Ministry Matriarch's madness, then so be it. Diablery will humour the Shoggoth's grievances."
You're not supposed to say that word any more either, Doctor, said Allison, as she took the driver's seat and pulled the door closed behind her.
His name's Shugtathuks. Diablery scowled beside her, staring straight ahead.
I will humour this assignment, he growled. I will tolerate the presence of a blight within my sanctum, but Diablery draws the line at giving the blight a name. Next it will be wanting to wear my hat, and none could foresee where it would end.
Allison let it drop.
She keyed in the address of the tin mine in Dartmoor, where Kaysen and Hesketh were theoretically waiting for them, then guided Diablerie's car out of the underground car park and into the streets of London. The three occupants of the car sat in three subtly different silences, each occupying different points on the sullen, embarrassed spectrum. Diablerie sat with arms folded, glaring at the passing scenery, while Shugthuks rolled over and over in his bucket, farting self-consciously. When the car was on the motorway, and after the first of the now-expected honks of derision from more sensible vehicles had passed, Allison coughed nervously. "Doctor, can I ask you something?"
"Have you forgotten the nature of our contract?" spat Diablerie. "You have no outstanding boons, girl."
Allison bit her lip. "Could I maybe get one in reserve?"
Diablerie's jaw dropped. "You offer a boon to me?"
"Is that all right?"
He shook his head, a perverse smile upturning his moustache. "Diablerie knows that the great negotiator shows not his hand, but you would do well to not bargain so freely with the forces of chaos. You have no understanding of what value a virgin soul carries in an open market. The contract is sealed. Ask your question."
Okay. "Do you think that when a magically infused person gets possessed by an ancient, is that necessarily bad?"
Diablerie sucked in his cheeks for a moment, then touched his temples with his fingertips. "Girl, it is not that, in purchasing this question, you sold a cow for a magic bean. It is that this was your third and final cow, and you have completed a master's degree in economics since the second."
"Seriously, though," pressed Allison, "if the person knows how to stop it but lets it happen anyway, isn't that their choice?"
"Girl, the last time you encountered a possessed, tainted one, as far as Diablerie knows, it was only Diablerie's quick thinking that saved you from being strangled to death."
Allison considered disputing this version of events, but resolved to stick to one argument at a time. "Yes, but should he have been locked up just for being possessed, or because he tried to kill me? Is it that possessed people are dangerous, or was he a dangerous person who just happened to be possessed?"
100% of the possessed tainted ones you have encountered have been hostile," argued Diablerie, his dictatorial air tinged with amusement. "Speaking from the depths of Diablerie's esoteric knowledge, your experience is by no means unrepresentative."
"Yes, but everyone used to think the same thing about fluidics, right? Because no one ever seriously tried to understand them."
"I have no opinion,"
added Shugthuks worriedly, whose enhanced fluidic senses offered a better sense for the emotions building up inside the car.
"If you recall, girl, the communication with Aaron Weatherby opened with him attempting to bewitch our minds and attack our person with knives. And if the next sentence that flies from your mouth begins with the words, 'Yes, but,' then you will find yourself beneath the scorching blaze of Diablerie's most fiendish ire."
"Well, we weren't being completely upfront either, were we? Maybe he didn't think we'd give him a chance. I don't know, I just think maybe possessed people are only hostile because no one's ever tried to treat them with respect and socialize them properly." There was a thoughtful pause. Diablerie cocked his head and peered at her through one slitted eye.
"To whom have you been speaking, girl?"
"What?"
"Thoughts such as these do not sprout unbidden in the bottomless cavern that is your mind. Someone must have placed them there. Whom?"
"Nobody."
"Do not lie to a master trickster."
Diablerie allowed a little anger to burn the edges of his statement. Allison hung her head and surrendered immediately. "There's this new advisor at the department. She bought me dinner and we had a really long talk. But I don't see why that makes the point."
"Diablerie is calling in his boon," he declared. "You are bound by the contract and helpless against Diablerie's will. I command thee to stop talking for the duration of this drive. Thus the pact is sealed."
Allison clamped her lips shut to halt the protest as it rose from her throat, ballooning her cheeks stupidly. She wasn't sure how much power the boon had, but she felt that, as with mental patients, little progress could be made with Diablerie by contradicting him. She focused on the drive, on keeping the car in the lane, and staying quiet.
After a tense 15 minutes, Shugshatux gave a little choking gurgle that was probably intended to be a polite cough.
"Can we have the wait here, one?"
26. Allison passed the time for the rest of the journey by memorizing the number plates of every car, as well as all the obscene gestures made by the drivers. Several dull hours later, they reached the overgrown B Road turn-off in Dartmoor that led to the tin mine. Allison would have driven straight past it if Adam Hesketh hadn't been waiting by the roadside to flag them down. "Oh, you brought a fluidic?" he said, as the three occupants of the car stumbled, stepped, and decanted themselves onto the grassy verge. "Is that okay?" asked Allison. "Yes," said Adam quickly. "Perfectly okay with me. I just thought, you know, would it be all right with them? The trauma, I mean?" Allison regarded Shugshatux as he joyously hoovered up some discarded plastic bags on the roadside. "I think he already had all the trauma when it happened, from the psychic link they've got."
"Oh, right. Sorry, it's just, you know, you never know when you need to be sensitive these days."
"Enough prattling, tainted one," interjected Diablery, who was still standing by the passenger door of the car with hand on hip. "Diablery would resolve this farce swiftly."
"Right this way?"
Adam began pushing his way through the undergrowth toward the fenced-off mine entrance, and Allison followed closely behind. Diablery brought up the rear, walking stiff-legged and straight, somehow avoiding every single piece of foliage with no apparent conscious effort. "Where's Victor?" she asked, as one would probe a mouth ulcer to check for pain.
"Waiting at the tunnel entrance," said Adam, lifting his chubby legs high to avoid stinging nettles.
Victor was sitting on a rusty metal drum turned on its side, staring at his phone like a monk in prayer. There was a crumpled carrier bag from the nearby service station at his feet, surrounded by discarded chocolate wrappers and energy drink cans. He glanced up when he heard Adam lumbering through complaining vegetation, and a sarcastic little smile tweaked the corner of his mouth.
"Oh, dear," he said. "I didn't realize this was a black tie crime scene. How's it going, Dabbers?"
"Your mockery betrays your fear, child of taint," answered Diablery, throwing up his cloak with particular indignance. "You would not speak so easily were you facing Diablery in a trial of psychic combat." "Isn't everyone a child of a taint?" said Victor, still smiling, addressing Adam and Allison. "Of something near the taint, anyway."
"Weak, dude," said Adam.
"Enough pleasantry," growled Diablery. He stalked straight past the mine entrance toward an ancient porter cabin nearby. "I must gather my energies before we begin, in private."
"Maybe you should have gone before you left," called Victor.
His statement was punctuated by Diablery violently slamming the porter cabin door.
"Is he in a bad mood?" asked Adam.
"I don't think he liked having to bring Shugshatux along," said Allison tactfully. "I think he might be a bit anti-progress." Victor boggled his eyes and framed his face in his hands.
"Now, the Phantom of the Opera is a bit behind the times. That really doesn't come across. Of course he's anti-progress, you idiot. The bloody Treaty of Versailles was a bit newfangled for his taste."
"All right, sorry," sighed Allison. She stared at the ground, awkwardly rocking on her heels as Diablery's usual strange vocalizations drifted through the flimsy porter cabin door. "Hey," she said, looking up. "You guys are magic-infused, right?" Victor looked at the palm of his hand, as if needing to be reminded.
Yeah. Turns out we are.
Do you think possessed people should be allowed their freedom?" Victor used the same hand he had been staring at to pinch the bridge of his nose.
"Oh, not you as well. Some crazy bint at the department sent an email around this morning, and he hasn't stopped going on about it."
"I happen to think she has a point,"
said Adam, at an uncharacteristically high volume.
"I never gave Arjean a chance just because the school told me not to."
He casually pronounced the GH with a gurgling sound from the back of his throat.
"And now I'm wondering if maybe she had something important to offer."
"Well, yeah, she was going to possess you and erase your being," said Victor. "I might have appreciated that, come to think of it. Maybe she and I'd get along better."
"They don't erase your being," protested Adam. "Apparently it's like you and the Ancient combine together to create a whole new being. You're still you, it's just you with the Ancient's thought processes as well."
Victor's expression darkened. "I got enough of an insight into Ifrig while he was keeping me awake back in the dorms, thank you very much. all that murder your friends, burn the world stuff. Don't think he's got much to contribute to polite society.
Alison tilted her head, interested. So your ancients actually talk to you?
Adam waggled a hand horizontally.
Not in coherent sentences. It was like whenever you used magic, you got this sort of impression of what they were thinking.
His gaze unfocused.
Alreen always seemed really sad.
Yeah, I would be too if I had nothing but your thoughts to keep me occupied.
You both went through the secondary school? Asked Alison.
Adam shuddered, grimacing in memory. Victor folded his arms defensively.
Certainly did, he said with a hint of pride. That's the other thing the crazy bitch was going off about. You don't agree with her, do you?
Alison tapped her index fingers together, glancing awkwardly to the side.
Wasn't it, you know, a bit oppressive?
Every day they made us walk around in circles for hours on end, said Adam, staring at the ground.
Oh, don't milk it. It was only 2 hours before lunch. Built up an appetite.
2 hours is still hours on end. There was a monk with a megaphone shouting instructions, and we had to obey straight away, because if we didn't, we'd have to spend an hour in the observation pit.
Hey, I'm not saying it was crumpets and rice pudding.
Victor tossed his head left and right, bored. But it needed to be like that. The megaphone thing is about enforcing what voices are coming from outside your head and what aren't. All I know is I went into the school with Ifrig trying to get me to set fire to everything, and by the time I got out, he'd given up. I don't think we should mess with a winning formula.
The point was, maybe not all ancients are like that, said Adam.
Hashtag not all ancients.
Wait, said Alison. The ancients don't talk to you any more.
No, said Adam, looking down guiltily. I think after a while they just sort of give up trying.
That's a bit sad, said Alison.
Yeah, I never really thought about it until now.
Victor rolled his eyes.
Ugh, you are such a sucker. It's only because you got a girl, ancient, who knew when to turn on the waterworks. Doesn't mean she had any nicer plans for the world. Just proves she was smarter than Ifrig.
He turned his head towards the porter cabin to end the argument and assume victory.
What the hell is keeping Dr. Caligari?
The porter cabin door remained closed. Alison noticed that she could no longer hear Diablerie's strange chanting. She assumed he had done enough gathering of energies, and was now opportunistically using the porter cabin for its intended purpose.
"Let's just start without him," said Victor. "Don't even know why we needed to wait for him in the first place."
"Do you know anything about crime scene investigating?"
asked Adam.
"I can tell you this, I'm more qualified than him."
Victor jerked a thumb towards the still silent porter cabin.
"Come on, we can go in and take some photos. Or just get Arkin to look around it, same thing."
Alison wrung her hands nervously, the teacher's pet being tempted to misbehave by her friends.
"I don't know," she said. "This is a real murder, guys. We have to take it seriously."
Victor gave her a piercing look.
"Do you really think the net amount of seriousness is going to increase with Diablerie involved?"
Alison looked down and saw Shugshathuk's a couple of feet away, searchingly fluttering himself through the grass.
"Hold on a second. Shugshathuk's... Are you getting anything from out here?"
"Yes," gurgled Shugshathuk. "Got 3 cigarette butts so far. Yum, yum."
Alison forced herself not to glance up and see what kind of looks Victor and Adam were giving each other. "I meant from the other fluidic. If you can tell us anything about the attack, or whatever."
"Oh, we really don't want to make a fuss."
"I know, Shugshathuk," sighed Alison, "but we do. You know? It's important to us to find out who could be doing things like this. Maybe it's an individualist thing."
"Okay."
Shugshathuk flattened himself against the grass, turning into a huge, semi-transparent cowpat, and Alison took a few steps back to give him room. A moment later, 100 thin tentacles burst from his form, waving back and forth like a sea anemone on the ocean floor.
"What's it doing?"
asked Victor, grimacing.
"I think he's searching," said Alison, not looking away.
"Shugshathuk, have you got anything?"
"Yes,"
said Shugshathuk's voice from the narrow mouth in the middle of the crowding tendrils, lent a sibilant quality by the acoustics of his new shape.
"I can feel Shugshathuk. He's not alone."
"Who's with him?" asked Adam.
"He can't see them."
A small clump of the tendrils began to move more quickly and urgently, and the rest began to fold towards them in waves.
"He's being chased."
"Through the mine?" prompted Allison, after Shuchathux went silent for a moment. The tendrils stiffened for a moment.
"He's afraid. He thinks the person chasing him is going to kill him. He can hear footsteps. There's pain. Something stings in his side.